Now, today is World Wildlife Day, and we thought we'd mark it by speaking about the most trafficked wildlife on Earth, the 8 species of pangolin. As you probably already know, demand for their scales and their meat has led to their being hunted to the point of near extinction. And now their possible link to COVID-19 has placed their future in even more jeopardy. My guest who joins us on the virtual couch today is a repeat visitor to the show. Conservationist and wildlife writer Richard Pearce has previously spoken to us about the extraordinary story of Nicole the Great White Shark, who was tracked all the way to Australia and back. I'm sure you remember that story. But more recently, he has published a book with Strike Nature called Pangolins, Scales of Injustice. And Richard, it's a great pleasure to welcome you back to the show. Lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you for asking me. I think this is the first virtual couch I've ever been on, so that's great.
I hope it's nice and comfortable, Richard. Okay.
It's fabulous. It's great.
So far, so good. Now, look, I know you've covered all kinds of wildlife during a long and varied career, but what was it that drew you specifically to pangolins this time?
Well, it was what you've already said, actually, the most trafficked wild mammal on the planet. When I sort of hear something like that, and I can't remember whether I read it first or heard it first, but it doesn't matter. You know, someone like me can't ignore that. And so when I heard that as a sort of claim or as a title or whatever, I thought, gosh, I've got to have a look at this and try and do something about it. And so, yeah, that's what led to the book. I mean, and I hope that the books I do in a small way help to raise awareness and ultimately help to raise the animals that I feature.
I really do think they do, because Richard, you've got such a good storyteller in you that is able to make us relate to the story of the animals and really get invested in the story of an individual who represents what's going on in a greater species, which you've done once again in this book by choosing the story of a pangolin nicknamed Zambezi and following his likely life journey from the moment of being caught to the moment he's in the hands of the poachers and then to the police operation that follows and beyond. I mean, that's a strategy, obviously, of making people care, that if you say 8 species of pangolins, 4 in Asia, 4 in Africa, it's still a very much sort of out there concept, whereas one creature that you give a name and a story to, people really get invested in.
Yeah, and you know, look, this was just amazing because it was a huge gift. I mean, when I met this guy, Professor Ray Janssen, in a cafe in Joburg a while back now, I guess, nearly 2 years ago, so a year and a half ago, you know, here's this guy who sits in cars with an automatic pistol, waiting, surrounded by sort of covertly hidden police, waiting for sting operations to go down so he can rescue pangolins. Now, you know, you called me a storyteller. You're right. That's what I am. And when someone starts telling you a story like that, hey, this is what I do every week, it's a gift to someone like me. So I had brilliant people, starting with Ray Janssen. You know, there's this kind of absent-minded professor guy who actually is a gun-toting wildlife hero. And then he told me about Zambezi, and then I met pangolins. And as a storyteller, the whole thing was gift wrapped. It was just brilliant. I've never had so much fun and been so driven. I mean, I was driving my wife crazy getting up at 3 a.m. thinking, hey, that's a bloody good idea, and running down to my studio and writing a bit more, because it just kept on like a load of fireworks going off. Boom, boom, boom. Great story. And I'm privileged to have been able to tell it.
And privileged to have met so many people in this chain, because, of course, what Ray is doing is one part of a remarkable story of rehabilitating pangolins which have been taken and rescued before they are sent off to the Far East. We've spoken on the show before to the team from Joburg Veterinary Wildlife Hospital, who are so keenly involved in the rehabilitation. And without giving too much away, I can tell you that this book and the story, particularly Zambezi's bit of it, looks into the work that they do rehabilitating those creatures that they can to release them back into the wild. Richard, to take a step back and look at the bigger picture, we're talking here about a massive trade whose scope we probably don't even really have a true sense of yet, because we know how many tons of pangolin scales have been intercepted on this continent. We don't know how many got out without being intercepted. But tell us a little bit about what we do know about the scope of the trade.
Okay, I'll do my best, but Ray put it very well. I heard him being interviewed about 2 or 3 weeks back, and he said the trouble is that we don't have today's data. We're always counting ghosts.
Yeah.
And what he meant by that is that we're working on the basis of figures of interception, interceptions and things like that. But just to give you an idea, between 2016 and 2019, there were 52 seizures of different shipments of pangolin scales leaving Africa for the Far East. Mm-hmm. That's roughly about 230 tons of scales. And people like Ray think that's only about 10%.
Wow.
In 2019, 97 tons, that's just 1 year, 97 tons were intercepted leaving Africa, mostly going through Nigeria. That's around about 160,000 animals. Now, if Ray and people like him are right, and I see no reason why they wouldn't be, if that's only 10%, Pippa, just think, 160,000, if that's 10%, that's 1.5 million pangolins. It's absolutely obscene.
Do we know how many are left, Richard? It is totally obscene. Well, do we know how many are left? I mean, I know they're very shy and nocturnal animals, not the easiest to track, but do we have a sense of their numbers?
Well, that you've hit the nail on the head. That's the problem. You know, we're counting ghosts, but we have no idea how many live ones are still out there. So the answer is no. We do know in Cameroon, for example, it was announced about 3 weeks ago that they're heading for local extinction in Cameroon. So I guess that's the problem. When they stop turning up in the markets, when they stop being caught for bushmeat and this, that and the other, then it's too late, of course. But then you know you're close to a local extinction. It's desperately sad. What I think we've got to do is hope that the demand end diminishes. And one of the pluses that I hope will come out of COVID-19, irrespective of whether it's ever proved to be that pangolin's the vector or not, one of the pluses I hope that comes out of it is I hope it slows down, or even better still, stops the Far Eastern consumption of wildlife. That's what the problem is. I mean, you can't have, there's no need for a supply unless you've got a demand. So it's the demand end that I would like to see go down. And I really hope this pandemic achieves a lot of resets. And one of them is a reset on consumption and demand.
As you say in the book, what has happened here, Richard, is that one particular culture's desire for an exotic, very special in their culture, plate of food has ended up being the most expensive meal the world has ever seen appear on a plate, because the cost of COVID-19 is running to trillions of dollars and global devastation. Look, as you say, it's all very still to be proven, but the proposition that has been put out there is that COVID-19 has arisen from bats as the reservoir species, moving on to pangolins as the vector species, and then on to humans, and that some kind of combination and recombination happened in that chain as it jumped to human beings. Somebody on my WhatsApp screen has said maybe the animals can think, and maybe pangolins got sick of being someone else's food. Could COVID be their revenge? You know, I had the same thought.
Can I just stop you there? That's a fascinating idea, because one of the most exciting people I interviewed for this book was a man called Isaac Kriker, who's a bushman up in near Uppington. He lives near Uppington. And he was telling me about pangolin's place in sort of bushman folklore. Yeah. And one of the tenets they hold closely to is that if you harm a pangolin, you will get sort of a curse. You will get bad luck. So maybe the person who just came into you and said maybe it's kind of pangolin's revenge. I know it sounds far-fetched, and of course it's far-fetched, and of course it isn't the case. But I often wonder when Mother Nature strikes back, whether or not she's going to strike back in a really terrible fashion. And I think we may be beginning to see that starting to happen. I hope not, but more and more.
Yeah. Richard, I will just say for listeners who might be interested in picking up the book, that your description of pangolins and of the reverence with which they are held in so many African cultures in particular is a very moving thing to read in this book. I mean, the COVID-19, when I first heard the question that pangolins might have played a role in the chain, my initial thought was that's a brilliant marketing strategy from some conservationist who wants to make people afraid to go near them. But then my second thought was, I hope this doesn't result in their being targeted for whole-scale killing, not no longer for eating their meat or for using their scales in traditional medicine, but simply because people want them gone out of fear. Are you worried that that might be one of the consequences?
Yeah. Not so much pangolins, actually, but bats. There have already been several instances around the world of bat colonies being targeted and basically wiped out of fear. which is mad because bats have got an extremely important place, like all species have, but bats have got an amazingly important place in ecosystems. And so it's insane. The bats didn't ask humans to eat them. The bats didn't ask humans to eat the pangolins or the civets or whatever it is. But no, that revenge thing really does worry me. The other thing that worries me is people like the FAO estimate that the amount of hungry Africans will increase dramatically in the next 5 years as a result of the various knock-ons from COVID. That being the case, the pressure on bushmeat, all types of bushmeat, can only increase. And that being the case, species like pangolins, which are already hugely targeted, must come under more and more and more pressure. I mean, I think we mustn't lose sight of the fact that 40% of Africans live on less than $2 a day. Mm-hmm. Now, people in Europe and the US and all the armchair sort of conservationists, they wouldn't know what it was like to be that hungry and that poor. But we can't condemn people for eating bushmeat. If you're hungry, you'll eat.
You'll eat anything. What's there. Yeah.
I would love to see big UN programs. I mean, there's so much money being borrowed all over the world at the moment, it blows your mind. I'd like to see big UN programs to make sure that African communities that are really on the brink of starvation actually have something to eat. I think that would also make a big contribution to wildlife.
Absolutely. Richard, there is this weird paradox when it comes to the pangolin trafficking issue, that some of the demand is, as you say, from people who are hungry and so hungry that they will eat anything. On the other end of the scale, there is demand coming from countries like Vietnam and Laos, where this is seen as an absolute super luxury dish. There, people are paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a plate of something that is bizarrely seen as a sign of social, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, but your status is associated with it.
And that's
driving this.
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head. It's like rhino horn. I mean, consumption is now one thing, but owning a piece of rhino horn as a piece of jewelry or an ornament or something, it is a status symbol. Take it out when you're drinking coffee with your friends in Starbucks and play with your bit of rhino horn. Pangolin is a status symbol. I mean, I'll very quickly tell you, and it won't give you any story, I won't give any away from the book. I went with no special introductions whatsoever to a restaurant somewhere in Vietnam. Let's just leave it there. Very quickly, I was offered pangolin. The first thing I was offered was civets. Well, civets were almost certainly the vector for the first SARS, which occurred in 2002-03. And then within minutes, my sort of saying, no, I don't want that. I want something different. I was offered pangolin. So there I was. And I was offered pangolin at $300 a kilo for meat. I hummed and hawed. So then I was offered the whole animal at $4,000 for the animal. I hummed and hawed, and then he clearly thought I was bargaining. So he said, okay, don't worry, I'll give you your own private dining room. So I was shown this private room off a main room set up for eight people. And the very strong inference was they'd bring the animal to the table. This is a bit horrible. I'm sorry about this. They'd bring the animal to the table and kill it in front of me so I could be sure that I was getting what I paid for. And I had there were no code words. There were no passwords. There was nothing secret about this. I was a Westerner walking in off the street and I was offered pangolin within 5 minutes. Yeah. So, yes, it's horrific.
I mean, Richard, you describe them in the book, some of these countries, as vast illegal wildlife supermarkets where you just have to walk into a market and it is there for the buying, despite the fact that technically this trade is forbidden in some of those countries, that they are signatories to the international agreements.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of hope that, you know, there was the initial closure of the wet markets in China in response to COVID. There's been a lot of hope that maybe the COVID outbreak will prompt these countries to review their take on wild species consumption. But then in the same breath, does it matter? Is there all the legislation in the world isn't going to change something if it is that blatantly ignored in practice?
Well, I think that might change. China did do a review of their law, and sadly, the review resulted in very minimal changes, which disappointed us all. Vietnam, in contrast, have put through much tougher sort of new laws, and they do appear, so all fingers crossed, they do appear to be policing them more robustly. And I think that's because no one actually wants to be tarred with the brush of having brought the world to its knees. My hope is that Vietnam, which is not insignificant, I mean, it's 110 million people or something, so a big market. If Vietnam can sort of shut down their markets, that will have an effect. And who knows, maybe the Chinese will follow suit. But we haven't got long for the penny to drop. They really do need to get real pretty soon, or Africa's wildlife is going to be in picture books.
Richard, the extraordinary thing towards the end of the book is to read that scientists actually published an article back in 2007 in which they said exactly what you've been saying, that this is a ticking time bomb, that the combination of the presence of these respiratory viruses in wild animals combined with the culture of eating exotic mammals in parts of Asia is a time bomb. And the words, and I'm going to quote here from the article, the possibility of the reemergence of SARS and other novel viruses from animals or laboratories, and therefore the need for preparedness, should not be ignored. Well, it was ignored. Those words were written in 2007. So are we learning anything? I guess my final question is, how hopeful or not hopeful are you feeling at this point in history?
Okay. I haven't sort of prepared for this, otherwise the list would be longer. but AIDS, SARS, MERS, Ebola, swine flu, bird flu, straight off the top of my head, all come from the animal kingdom. So at first glance, it wouldn't appear that we're learning very much, would it? But do I have hope? Yeah, of course, because someone like me, if they don't have hope, would have to go and find a lamppost and a piece of rope and hang themselves. So I have to wake up every day being an optimist. It's difficult some days to be an optimist, but, you know, you go outside and no matter what country you're in, you go outside, you see a wild animal, you see a bird, you see a good sunset, you see something, you see a bit of human kindness and you say, hey, yeah, OK, let's carry on being an optimist. Let's carry on fighting for it. And so that's what I do.
Richard, thank you for sharing that message with us today and through the pages of this book. It is called Pangolins, Scales of Injustice. You've been listening to the author, Richard Pierce, speaking to us there. The book published by Straight Nature, and you can find it in a softcover version at around 200 Rand and an ebook at 160 Rand. It's in all the major bookstores as we speak. And always lovely to chat to you, Richard. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.